Well, again, it's our privilege to have Brother Allen's service. We get to have a national and an international flavor all in one, Brother Allen. So his subject for this morning is very simply titled, Soup and Nuts. Soup and Nuts, Brother Allen.
Thanks, Brother Aaron. Well, brethren, first of all, you have love and greetings from your brethren in the Sighet Ecclesia in Romania, where I participate. Also, the Sunday evening study online, which covers a number of countries in Europe who have English as their second language, but a common language. And then from the Wenatchee Bible students in Washington State. Soup and nuts. I'm sure you're all thinking from soup to nuts. Well, that's not it. Because it's not going to cover everything. It's only going to cover two small subjects, and neither one of them was big enough for a full meal, if you will. So these are all two side dishes, you might say. You know, I also want to acknowledge the grace and mercy and overruling of the Lord for the fact that I'm here. I'm here because of Brother Seth and Sister Alina's wedding, and I'm so thankful the Lord permitted me to be here and therefore to be with you today. Okay. There's a few soup stories in the Bible, and my favorite is the one that we find in Genesis chapter 25. Genesis 25, especially verses 28 to 34. And there's a reprint 4722, reprint 4722. Jacob and Esau in a new light. Well, I think you know which soup story this is. It's a story about a contrast between earthly good things and spiritual promises. That's the contrast. You know, there's this expression like father, like son, and that fits into this story. And also like mother, like son fits into this story because there's two sons. And Isaac loved Esau mostly for the wrong reasons. And there's a lesson in that in itself. Esau was a hunter. He was a man's man. He was hairy and big and macho, is the saying. He had a lot of manly prowess. And besides that, not only was it a son that, you know, Isaac felt proud of this son, but Isaac liked venison. So there was that reason too. So you can see that his motives were mostly earthly, material, and even somewhat selfish. Now we can't help but think about the successors of Isaac, the Jewish nation. And when God looked at their attitude about what kind of a king they were going to want for their first king, he gave them the kind of king they wanted. And that was Saul. He had a lot of these characteristics of Esau. But they were looking at the outward appearance, not at the man of the heart. And God chose for his choice the second king, which was King David. And we see a similar contrast between Esau and Jacob. Now, there was one proper reason why Isaac favored Esau, and that's because Esau was the firstborn. But we have to wonder why Isaac didn't remember his own personal experience in a similar situation with his brother Ishmael. You know, Isaac was also a second born. In fact, if you look at the scriptures, you'll find there's a consistent pattern with the second born. And you know, I've heard brethren say, you know, it fits all the way along except for Jesus. Well, I'll suggest a possibility even for Jesus. Because who was the first man? Well, it was Adam. And who's the second Adam? It's Jesus. That's a side story. Now, Rebecca favored Jacob. And she favored Jacob for the right reasons. And it was because of the promise. The promise given to Abraham. We'll go into that in some detail. But basically, if we were to put it in a very concentrated form, Esau loved soup more than the promises of God. He was materialistic. What's the lesson for us? There's three possible areas that we can look at here. Number one, Esau can represent natural Israel. Esau can also represent nominal Christendom. And from a literal standpoint, Esau is one of the ancestors of modern-day Arabs. And we'll briefly examine each of these three. But before we do, we want to get into the story as to what took place there, and primarily, why was Esau hungry? Why was Esau hungry? And this Tower article suggests a possibility which I'd never seen before. It was quite interesting to me. And it gives it a much greater depth of meaning than what I had seen before. The usual thought is, well, Esau was out hunting, he didn't catch anything, and so he's hungry, and he comes to his brother, and he sees the soup, and so he wants some soup. But it's a lot deeper than that. This tower suggests that that particular day was a very special festival or feast that was related to their grandfather, Abraham. Now, I found two possibilities on researching this. Brother Russell in this article suggests that it may simply have been Abraham's birthday and that they were celebrating his birthday. They were honoring Abraham and honoring the promise by having a special feast. The other possibility is equally credible, and that is that they were still young men. Abraham died when they were 15 years old. And some Bible scholars say that this was a feast day of mourning related to Abraham's death. It doesn't matter which one. The point is, it was a special feast day. And related to that special feast day, the firstborn was supposed to fast all day. Not eat anything all day. The firstborn. And Jacob had the privilege of preparing the feast, but Esau was supposed to fast. That's why he was hungry. Now, Jacob didn't normally fix the meals, and that immediately makes us suspicious as to why he was doing this. And Esau was a mighty hunter and a very efficient one, and that also makes us suspicious as to why he hadn't caught anything. So all of these are circumstantial evidences which support the idea that it was this special feast day, and that the firstborn Esau was not supposed to eat, and Jacob had the privilege of preparing the food. It's the most logical scenario, we believe. But more importantly, most importantly, what would it mean if Esau broke the fast? It meant that he did not honor his father Abraham. It meant that he did not honor the promise to Abraham. And according to tradition, it meant that he automatically would lose the birthright. Esau, another circumstantial point here, Esau would not normally be required to go to Jacob and purchase food from him for some kind of price. He was the firstborn. He would just see Jacob fixing this, and he would say, give me some of that. He had the right to do that. He was the firstborn. The fact that he did ask for it is significant. But there's another aspect here that is suggested in this article in verse 31. It casts a totally different light on verse 31 as not being a command, but being a rhetorical question. Verse 31 says, "Sell me this day thy birthright?" If you make it a rhetorical question, it gives a whole different meaning to the context. Brother Russell, in the article, he paraphrases it as, "Are you joking? Are you kidding?" Because Jacob knew the consequences, and Esau knew the consequences. And the fact that Jacob made him swear was because he wanted to be sure. Are you really sure that you know what you're doing? You really want to do this? You really are willing to sell me your birthright by breaking the fast? By me giving you of this soup? Now we can see that whether Esau swore or not on this occasion, because he failed to keep the fast, the birthright automatically passed to Jacob. But it cost Jacob something. Well, not the soup, that was trivial. And Jacob, by taking the place of Esau, he had to fast instead of his brother. Jacob had tremendous respect and honor for his father Abraham. And it may very well be that he already was fasting and that the Lord arranged it that way in order for this transaction to take place. But even that, the fasting was not the main thing. He had to refrain from the feast. He couldn't participate in this feast, which was respecting and honoring Abraham. And he loved Abraham. He respected, he honored him. He wanted to participate. But notice the irony of the situation. Because of the transaction which took place, it turns out he was able to honor and respect Abraham and the promise in the greatest way possible, much greater than simply fixing the meal for his family. He gained the heirship of the promise. He honored Abraham even more by the course that he chose. But even Esau doesn't lose everything in this deal, because we know that later on, he was greatly advantaged from an earthly standpoint. Okay, that's the literal, and I'm sure your minds are already thinking about what some of the lessons are that could be drawn from this, and there's more than one. The Apostle Paul in Romans 9 suggests one of those scenarios, and he tells us that Esau represents natural Israel and Jacob represents the new creation in this incident. And we think it fits. It fits. You can look at it. The Jews, natural Israel, did not appreciate the promise that was given to them. Not fully. They did not honor Abraham in the sense of blessing all the families of the earth through that promise. They did not receive the spiritual reward except for the remnant, which we saw earlier this morning, but they received an earthly promise instead, as with Esau. Jacob represents a new creation. The new creation, spiritual Israel, as with Jacob, respect the promise. They honor the Abrahamic covenant, and they receive the inheritance, the spiritual inheritance, the privilege to bless all the families of the earth. But like Jacob, they give up all the earthly good things. You remember that Jacob had to flee to a far country. And even though he was still entitled to the inheritance, the firstborn's inheritance, he fled. He lost all of that. So it's a beautiful picture of the covenant by sacrifice. Well, that's one picture, as mentioned, that we find in Romans 9. You have another picture concerning the true and the nominal church. And you'll find some suggestions about this on volume 4, page 14, D14. Esau would represent the nominal church. Jacob would represent the true church. And here it also fits. How many times does the Lord give us multiple threads of prophecy that weave together and form a consistent pattern? It's a nice soup. The nominal church does not really appreciate the promise, the original promise. They do not honor the covenant by sacrifice. They chose and choose worldly fame and honor instead. That's particularly true of the institutions. We're not necessarily talking about the people. And so they lose the heirship. And we know this because the scriptures tell us, many shall come to me in that day and say, have we not done all of these wonderful things and miracles and so on? And they'll say, sorry, I never knew you. It's not that they did bad things necessarily, but they didn't respect the promise to bless all the families of the earth. They had too much of a materialistic attitude. The true church appreciate the promise. They honor the covenant by sacrifice. They renounce the worldly things and they gain the heirship. So it's a consistent lesson. Well, the third one, maybe you haven't thought about this. It's the literal take, the literal angle. And many times the Lord also gives us a literal take on something in order to draw our attention to the symbolic, but also to just give us another aspect. And that is natural Israel and the Arabs. And this is just a suggestion, but I can't help but look at this and say, well, Jacob is the ancestor of the Jews, natural Israel. And Esau is an ancestor of the Arabs. Proof of that you'll find in Genesis 28, verse 9. And it's there that we see that Esau intermarried with the line of Ishmael. And, of course, we all know that Ishmael is in the lineage of the Arabs. Think about the practical aspects of this and why the Lord had to arrange it this way. What if this hadn't happened? Esau was the firstborn. He had the right to the heirship. He had the right to the promise. The promise should have and would have gone through Esau and not through Jacob. And of course, the Arabs, they'll say, well, that's exactly what happened. Of course, they go back to Ishmael. But God had something else in mind. Because, again, he reads the heart. He wasn't looking at the outward appearance. And there's that original lesson. It was the difference between Isaac's attitude and Rebekah's attitude. The difference between natural Israel's attitude concerning a king and God's attitude concerning a king. Later on, also in Genesis 28, verses 1 to 4, this is after this incident occurs with the soup and so on, Isaac recognizes the transfer. And he says so in those verses. For sake of time, we won't read them. But even Isaac recognized the transfer that took place. Now, how do we fit this into the other scenario? Because in the other scenarios, you know, in the first scenario, we had spiritual Israel is the good guy and natural Israel is the ones who didn't favor or respect the covenant. Well, here it's a different aspect, the contrast between the Jews and the Arabs. And natural Israel, as we learned in the first hour today, natural Israel will have a special role in the kingdom. They will have a special place in the Abrahamic promise. They will be the earthly seed that will bless all the families of the earth. Granted, they are subservient and beneath the spiritual phase of the kingdom, but it is a valuable and an important role from a literal standpoint. And this has cost the natural Jews much over the centuries. You think about all the suffering, all the persecution. Well, what was it for? It has a similar scope and purpose as it does for us as the new creation. We're being prepared for our administrative role in the kingdom arrangement, the natural Jews who have the faith of Abraham are being prepared for their administrative role in the earthly phase of the kingdom. Those among them who honor Abraham will be blessed, and they will be a blessing agent for the rest of the world, the Gentiles, including the Arabs. The Arabs will eventually, I believe, make peace with the Jews. We find that picture in Genesis 32, if it's a picture. And they both will prosper. Whether that happens before or after Jacob's trouble is another subject. Well, there's two more varieties of soup which we're not going to consider, and they're not really related that I could see. Someone here will probably find a connection. And that would be Gideon's broth soup of Judges chapter 6 and the poison soup of the sons of the prophets that was healed by Elisha in 2 Kings 4, 38 to 41. We won't consider those. That's subject number one. That's the first aperitif, or whatever you want to call it. Now we go to nuts. Well, there are several accounts of nuts found in the scriptures, and I'm talking about the natural kinds of nuts. There was Jacob's gift to Joseph, and you find that in Genesis 43:11. When they were going, they didn't know who Joseph was yet, and they were going to go there to pay him the money that was returned in their sacks the first time. And just to be sure, Jacob says, you know, we better give him something extra. So he picked the best gift he could think of to give to this king. And what did he give him? He gave him balm, honey, pistachios, and almonds. So you'll notice there's two different kinds of nuts there. And the thing that all four of these have in common is that they were all scarce in Egypt. And that's why Jacob picked those. Because he thought, here is something that Joseph probably doesn't have, though he didn't know his name was Joseph. And therefore it was precious. Scarce and precious. Another story concerning nuts, if you will, is the golden candlestick. In Exodus chapter 25 and Exodus chapter 37. And you remember that the oil cups, they were in, what were they in the shape of? They were almond blossoms. And there were almond shapes in that golden candlestick. It's a beautiful symbol of the church. And then you have Jeremiah's vision of chapter 1 in Jeremiah, especially in verse 11. And it involved a wooden staff. And guess what kind of staff it was? It was an almond rod, an almond staff. And we'll say more on that in a moment. But we want to focus on a fourth story. And that's one we find in Numbers 17. And that is Aaron's rod. And of course, we all know that Aaron's rod also was an almond rod. Well, I don't think it's an accident that we find almonds mentioned in all four of these pictures. But we want to give a little background here first. Why Numbers 17 even had to take place? It was because of what took place in Numbers 16. And that was the rebellion of Korah. You may remember that Korah, who was a Levite, as we know from Numbers 16:1, he gathered together 250, I believe it was, of the most influential amongst the tribes of Israel. And he brought them to the tabernacle, and they staged a protest. And the issue at hand was divine authority. Divine authority, that was the issue. They questioned the authority of Aaron and his sons. Who among the Levites should be head or chief? Who should be the priests? And Korah felt and says that he had as much right to be a priest as Aaron had. Well, you know what happened there in Numbers 16. Moses was told by God what to say to them. And he says, okay, God doesn't like what you're doing here. And something's going to happen. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. And it's a very unusual thing. And I'm pointing out that it's unusual so that you'll know this is from God. And you remember, the earth opened up, swallowed Korah and his family. And then it closed again. And then fire comes down from heaven and consumes all the 250. But didn't consume their censers. They collected the censers and they made a covering that was to be a memorial. So, you'd think that would have settled the matter of authority, wouldn't you? But it didn't. The Jews, bless their hearts, they are a stiff-necked and stubborn generation. Well, that's going to be to their advantage eventually, based on the first story we looked at. But that was not really a good thing in that situation. So, the next day, they don't really accept God's judgment as God's judgment. They go to Moses and say, you killed our brethren. So that's why this test of authority had to take place, which we find in Numbers, the 17th chapter. By the way, it's this account that helps us to define rod as a symbol for authority. And the proof that God used to show that Aaron was his choice and that Aaron had the authority, he chose almonds. That was his proof. It involved almonds. Again, we don't think that's an accident. Well, let's get into a little bit. You know, why almonds? Why not the fig tree? Or why not the olive tree? You know, olive wood, that's real strong, beautiful. No, God chose almonds. Why is that? Some of you probably know. There's a consistent picture in the scriptures concerning almonds. The almond tree comes from a Hebrew word. I pronounce it shakaid. A Hebrew would pronounce it differently, but it doesn't matter. That's the Hebrew word and has a meaning. And the meaning is to awake. One of its meanings is to awake. And why does the almond tree have that designation? Because the almond tree is the first tree in springtime to awake and to blossom and to bud and so on. But it has another meaning which is related. To be awake or to watch. So they're related, but they're used in two different senses. And there's an interesting play on words in Jeremiah 1, which we already looked at, but in verses 11 and 12. God says to Jeremiah, what seest thou, Jeremiah? And, you know, Jeremiah has this vision, and Jeremiah says, I see shakaid, an almond rod. And God says, you have seen correctly, for I am shakaid, but using it in the sense of watching. I am watching over my word to accomplish it and to perform it. What's the point? Why this prophecy? Well, again, we'll touch on that in a moment. But God was saying something to Jeremiah concerning his watch care, his watchfulness, his wakefulness towards them, towards him. So we see that the almond carries special significance. Now let's go back to Numbers 17, where we started, and see the connection. There's a connection between three things that are mentioned in Numbers 17, and we'll eventually get to that by the end, what that connection is. But we know, first of all, that the rod represents authority. But God specifically chose an almond rod, and there's a reason that he chose an almond rod. He also, in this test, he mentions three things. That the almond rod brought forth buds. That means something. The almond rod brought forth blossoms. That means something. And the almond rod brought forth almonds. Three different things, related, but each carrying a separate lesson. Well, what have we seen so far in the scriptures concerning almonds? In the Jacob and Joseph picture, the gift that was taken to Egypt, almonds were scarce in Egypt and therefore precious. Well, what does that bring to your mind if you're trying to make a spiritual application of that? The Lord's people, they're also scarce. They're also precious. And you know there is that verse that we are a peculiar people, and we tend to think, yeah, we're pretty peculiar. And the nuts kind of thing fits right in with that. The world certainly thinks we're nuts. But the Lord says, yeah, they're nuts, but they're a special kind. They're almonds. They're precious. Because that word peculiar means precious or purchased. And purchased because they're precious. And in other pictures, I will make up my jewels and so forth. And of course, Egypt is a symbol of the world. And these things were scarce in Egypt. And that's true. The Lord's people are in the world, but not of the world. And they are scarce and they are precious. But just as it was in the Aaron picture, the Lord's people are many times despised in spite of their preciousness. Because the world doesn't see that. I guess there is a connection here between Esau and Jacob. Because Esau didn't really appreciate the preciousness of the promise that was given to his brother Jacob because he gave it up. And we saw that divine authority is involved in the picture with Aaron and the priesthood. Now, this wasn't anything new. The Israelites had already seen how God had used Aaron and that rod. Because they're already in the wilderness at this point. What had happened before that? Well, when they were in Egypt, Aaron used that same rod of authority in the first three plagues. The first three plagues, it was Aaron's rod that was used. And the Jews knew that. So it's a symbol of authority, divine authority. And God's divine appointment of Aaron was proven by means of that rod. And we believe that eventually the Lord will manifest his approval of the church, but he has already manifested his approval of the church even during the gospel age. And we'll make that connection here shortly. But we also have seen that divine watch care is involved because that Hebrew word means watching, wakefulness. Now, this watch care aspect was demonstrated in the situation with Aaron and the rebellion of Korah, because God was watching over Aaron and his family. If God hadn't done something like he did there with the destruction of Korah and his family and the 250, you probably would have had a revolution, and it's possible that they might even have stoned Aaron. You remember they wanted to stone Moses on another occasion. So that's not out of the question. So God's watch care was certainly shown in a literal way there. But the watch care aspect was emphasized and is shown even more prominently in the Jeremiah chapter 1 account. Jeremiah was a priest. Well, that fits our general scenario here. And we believe that in this context, he pictures the new creation, the royal priesthood. If you look at verse 10, it is clearly recognized as a messianic prophecy. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. Well, we believe that that is a prophecy of the transition period. The transition time in which we believe that we are living. The old order is being destroyed. It's being rooted out, pulled down, and will eventually be thrown down and utterly destroyed. But there is also a building aspect involved. So this prophecy is describing the transition period of the kingdom. And it reminds us of Psalm 46, and there's a lot of beautiful expressions there, but you know them by heart, I'm sure. Even though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, well, what's our attitude? We believe that the Lord will, what? He'll watch over us. Shakaid. And that was what God gave to Jeremiah as a proof. He says, you're going to be doing all this stuff, and I'm going to take care of you. It was given to him as a proof, and it's no accident that that proof involved the almond. It was an assurance to Jeremiah of the truthfulness of God's promise, and it was an encouragement to him, even in the midst of trouble, and of course, it applies to us. But the other aspect of the word is also significant. The awakening aspect is involved. And when you think of new creation, you think of the time of transition we're in, and you think of awakening, perhaps your minds are drawn to the first fruits picture. And in this case, the first fruits are the almonds. In fact, some Hebrew scholars, when talking about this account, we're talking about in Jeremiah 1, they denote it as showing the power of the resurrected priest of God. The power of the resurrected priest of God. It's a very fitting picture when we look at the overall scenario. Well, brethren, that completes the picture for us. It is a symbolic portrayal of the divine priesthood's authority. And that picture covers the gospel age as well as the millennial age, because it is a complete picture because of the manner in which it is given to us in the picture with Aaron. Because it doesn't just simply say, well, the rod brought forth almonds. That only gives you one part of the picture. But it brought forth buds and blossoms and then fruit. And we believe it shows the progression, and it also shows God's approval. It shows God's approval of the church in the flesh, even during the gospel age, before the final fruitage is brought forth. And it shows God's approval of the church in glory. And it shows the resurrected priesthood with power to accomplish all God's purposes. Well, I told to the chairman that, you know, it's better to end early than to end late. And so we're going to end early today, and we're going to give you extra time for fellowship. And I hope that our consideration of soup and nuts will whet your appetite for what comes later. I'm not talking about lunch today. Maybe that'll be a reminder, but we're talking about the main course, which is yet to follow, that grand feast which the Lord has prepared, and not only for us, but for everybody. Bon appetit.